This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today my guest is Claudio Ferlan. Claudio is the author of The Jesuits, a thematic history, published by Institute of Jesuit Sources at Boston College in 2023. In this book, Claudio provides an exploration of the tradition of the Society of Jesus. Instead of focusing only on the Society's historical milestones and changes, Claudio Ferlan traces the continuity of key Jesuit themes over time, covering education, mission, social engagement, and more. So the book moves between different periods and places, emphasizing how core Jesuit themes have retained their essence despite profound transformations in the society and the world. Whether the reader is a scholar in Jesuit studies or simply interested in the society's history, the book really offers an analysis, and a compelling one, of one of the enduring religious orders of the Roman Catholic Church. But before we delve into all of this, first things first, Claudio, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me as a listener of the New Books podcast. I'm very happy to be with you, Roberto. Thank you very much.
A disclaimer for all of the listeners. Today is a fully Italian episode, as both myself and Claudio are Italian. And so I hope the listeners will enjoy our Italian accent. But I want to start asking something about yourself, and more importantly, about the origins of this book.
Oh, I've been working for 13 years in a research institute in Trento, Italy, and the Italian-German Historical Institute of the Bruno Kessler Foundation is a 50-year-old research institute. And during these years, I had the opportunity to travel a lot and work in different research contexts, all of which were exciting and inspiring, in Austria, in Germany, in France, soon in Portugal, and also in the United States, where I have been visiting researcher at UC Berkeley and Boston College. And the collaboration with Boston College has been consolidated over the years, and today I'm affiliated researcher at the Institute for Advanced Jesuit Studies at Boston College. In parallel to my commitment as a researcher, I am also involved in public history, like you. I'm a science journalist. I collaborate with various Italian newspapers. I am the owner of a podcast. I have my own website, claudioferlan.com. In short, I try to talk about history through as many media as possible. The origins of my book. I started studying the Jesuits even before I graduated. And do you know why? Because my professor of history of Christianity in Trieste, Italy, my alma mater, the name is Liliana Ferrari, the name of my professor, she immediately recognized my passion for documents, for sources, and advised me to research Jesuit sources in detail. The Jesuits have indeed left us an invaluable legacy of documents. I started from a little research on a mission trip of a strange guy from Spain to Peru and have not stopped since. And this particular book, The Jesuits at Thematic History, is the result of a visiting semester I spent at Boston College in 2019, before COVID. There I was able to work in a team, a way of doing research that is, in my opinion, invaluable to the historian. I was discussing my research projects, mostly devoted to the history of Jesuit food culture. And my predilection for synthetic work gave Casey Beaumier, the director of the Institute, the idea of suggesting that I write a new history of the Society of Jesus, intended not only for scholars and historians, but for curious readers, so to speak. And based on this proposal, which obviously I accepted, we worked together, we worked hard, and here we are. We have a book today.
But you already had a book about the history of the Society of Jesus. So I would like to ask, how does this current book, which is a thematic history of the Jesuits, how does this work differ, is different from your previous one?
Sure. I think that the story of my first book may be of interest of our listeners. It tells just a little of the peculiarity of Italian culture and its relation to the affairs of the Catholic Church. So when the first Jesuit Pope in history, Francis, was elected, it was March 13, 2013, I was discussing with an Italian publishing house, Il Mulino, a book project on the history of the Jesuit missions in South America. In this planned book, I wanted to compare the missionary methods of the Jesuits in Europe, Italy, Austria, and Germany in particular, and in South America, especially in Paraguay and Peru. But, there is always a but in our life, the election of the new Pope aroused great interest, not just in Italy, but above all in Italy. And my publisher, or rather what would become my publisher in later years, realized that they did not have a book, an entire catalog that could satisfy this curiosity. So they suggested I fill the gap and write a short history of the Jesuits. So the book I wrote was this new proposed book, The Concise History. And I did not write the one about the mission in South America. And it remains a project in the drawer, developed only through a few articles. And to write the Jesuits in Italian, I drew mainly on the many excellent works of my colleagues and on what I had studied up to that point. I worked with a chronological perspective from the beginnings of the Society of Jesus in 1540 to the election of Pope Francis. And to tell this story, I chose mainly European example so that they would be familiar to an Italian reader. Even if my book was translated a couple of years after in Brazilian Portuguese, but I wrote this for the Italian reader. And the partial exception was the chapter on the missions, where I have tried to offer a key that was not exclusively chronological, but above all thematic. And this attempt satisfied both the publisher and the readers I met at public presentation of the book. And this idea of emphasizing themes rather than years or centuries never left me. And when I started discussing the American book, let us call it, that one we are presenting today, when I started, I asked to organize a study seminar within the Institute of Advanced Jesuit Studies and shared my idea to work on the history of the Jesuits, not from the beginnings to the present, but by identifying the basic themes of their history and studying them through the centuries, highlighting the continuities of history. My colleagues liked the project. I got a lot of interesting feedbacks and started working on this topic. And this track that today has become the Jesuits a thematic history. I'm very pleased, to be honest, with this work because I think that the thematic perspective can open up new angles of the history of the Jesuits. And more importantly, I hope that this perspective can stimulate new research because we always need new research.
Now, let me ask about the sources that you have used for this work. I'm also interested about the problems that somehow you discuss throughout the text that are related to the sources themselves.
Oh yeah, I've already mentioned my passion for sources. Sources are beautiful. They are the reason why I'm a historian, I think, along with Western comics and movies. I was and still am fascinated by good comics, books, and Western movies. And I also realized this power of sources when I present my books in libraries or bookstores. I try always to quote some document, and the readers are interested in it. It stimulates their curiosity, like mine. Sources are interesting. And the Society of Jesus is a religious order that has been very much linked to sources since its beginnings. The founding father, Ignatius of Loyola, asked his confreres to keep in touch and tell their stories through letters that they sent at regular intervals from all over the world and that were collected in Rome. And today there is a great archive in Rome, staffed by wonderful and competent people like my friends Mauro Brunello and Sergio Palagiano. And here you can really immerse yourself in the past. And when I got to Rome to study, I also thanked the decision I made at the age of 14. I chose to go to a high school which still offers a very good humanistic education in the Italian school system, with the study of the Latin language at its heart. Learning Latin since I was a teenager has opened the doors to the past for me and to travel, both figuratively and by plan. So I would say that the first problem with Jesuit sources is that you have to know the languages in which they are written. In the first centuries of the history of the Society of Jesus, Latin is absolutely predominant. But many documents are written in languages derived from Latin, like Italian, Spanish, and to a lesser extent, Portuguese and French. The Jesuits began like 2 centuries ago to make these sources as accessible as possible. Their research institute began systematically publishing editions of the sources as early as the late 19th century, and many of these books can be found online today for free. The Jesuits began printing and distributing missionary letters as early as in the 18th century. They called them edifying and curious letters, and the first editions were in French. However, as all historians know, there is a big difference between unwritten documents and those published in books. The former, the unwritten, can have 1,000 different characteristics. Why were they written? To whom were they addressed? Did those who wrote them want to complain, to denounce someone or something, and so on? The sources that are, let's say, edited and published are different. They are documents that have been selected for dissemination. And let me give you an example. Well, last year, I was working in an archive in Rome, not the one I told you about, but another one where some documents of the Italian Jesuits from the 19th century, some words are kept, and where another good friend, Maria Macchi, a very good archivist, works. And I was reading about letters from Italian missionaries who work in the United States, in New Mexico and Colorado. Well, the Jesuits in Naples had decided to publish in their magazine a letter that a missionary had written, but they hadn't copied the whole letter. They had deleted a passage in which the Jesuit denounced the behavior of some of the brethren who were on the mission with him. So the readers of the journal should only learn what had gone well, but not what had gone wrong. All this is to emphasize the second great aspect of Jesuit sources, their richness and diversity. And traveling among these sources is like hiking in the mountains, you know. You need a compass to find your way. And do you know how to buy this compass, Roberto? In my opinion, there is only one way. You have to study the context and also rely on the work of the many colleagues who dealt with the history of the Jesuit for my side.
Now, I want to talk about the main character of the story. Now, obviously, the book is about the society, but as you mentioned, the society was established and founded by, well, his original name, Inigo de Loyola. And I was wondering if you can just give us a brief sense of his history, who is Inigo de Loyola, but more importantly, a little bit of a history, shall we say, in a nutshell, of the society itself.
Sure, it's fundamental to do it. Inigo de Loyola, like you mentioned, was the name the future Ignatius of Loyola had as a child, as a boy, and as a young man. He was a soldier and led a rather dissolute life. He ended up in prison, for example. In 1515, he was seriously wounded during a battle in one of the many wars of the 16th century between Spain and France. Inigo was a Basque nobleman and therefore fought in the Spanish army. He was wounded, and during his recovery, he had a mystical crisis, converted, and decided to dedicate his life to God. He also changed his name in the following years from Inigo to Ignatius. We can say that from this wound, from a broken leg, the Society of Jesus was born. And speaking of Ignatius of Loyola, I would like to tell you and our listeners an episode that shows how important teamwork is for historians too, and not just for hard scientists. I resolved the draft of this book with a good friend and colleague, Cristiano Casalini, and I sometimes used borrowed from Italian to define the Jesuits, Ignatian order. And Cristiano asked me, are you sure about that term? The Franciscans were founded by Francis, the Dominicans by Dominic, but the Jesuits have a different history. He was right, you know, my friend Cristiano was right. And I tried to remove Ignatian order from the book. It is not a decisive choice. It is certainly not wrong to speak of the Ignatian order. We can understand ourselves. But our choice helps to keep in mind that Ignatius was certainly the absolute protagonist in the founding of the Jesuits. That without him, the Society of Jesus would not exist. But also that the path taken by the Jesuits was that of a group of founding fathers, not that of one individual, however charismatic. So, there is another fundamental point in the history of the Jesuits. In 1773, Pope Clement XIV suppressed the Society of Jesus. Why did he do this? There were many reasons, many related to the political situation of the time. I hope that these reasons are clearly explained in the pages of my book. What I want to emphasize here, however, is that the suppression did not extinguish the Jesuits. Many of them resisted, and in different ways. They found various creative ways for the Society of Jesus to survive, despite the papal measure. Another Pope, Pius VII, restored the Society of Jesus in 1814. And these 40 years of only apparent emptiness are one of the main reasons for my decision to write a thematic histories, to tell how a group of people survived the adversities of time and history. I needed a perspective other than chronological. What do the almost 500 years of Jesuit history consist of? Of mysticism and theology, of education and pedagogy, of mission and pastoral care, of science, art, in short, of many things. The Jesuits were and are active in all fields of knowledge, and they have left behind memories of all their activities, speaking of archives. More studying them is also fun, I promise.
You just mentioned education, and we'll talk about it. And I'm thinking about the fact that where I'm sitting now, I'm literally surrounded by Jesuit institutions. In fact, dedicated to Loyola. I mean, I live no more than 10 minutes away from Loyola Academy and no more than 30 minutes away from Loyola University. And so you can really see the power of education, Jesuit educations, at work physically in the surrounding world. But let me ask about chapter one of your book. And chapter one is very much about identity. So can you tell us more about Jesuits' identity? And I'm very much interested in the question also of spiritual exercise that you discuss in this chapter, something that I was not aware at all that was a Jesuit sort of invention.
The first chapter of the book, Identity, begins with a concise biography of Ignatius of Loyola and the fundamental contribution that his thinking and experiences made to the formation and early development of the Society of Jesus. It's important to highlight Ignatius of Loyola relevance. But it's repeatedly pointed out also that he was by no means a loner, but that he had many capable collaborators. Spiritual exercises, it's very, very important for Jesuit identity. The spiritual exercises are the spiritual practice of those who wish to become members of the Society of Jesus, but also of those who wish to live their Catholic faith by following the principles that form the basis of Jesuit identity. Spiritual exercises are not just for Jesuits. And let us try to summarize them. A constant examination of conscience with the aim of recognizing the plan that God does for each individual. A plan of actions aimed at putting this plan into practice. Prayer, contemplation, preaching, good deeds, like visiting sick and prisoners. There is, in my opinion, a description that perfectly summarizes the Jesuit way of life. Contemplatives in action. I have suggested Contemplatives in Action as a title or subtitle for both my books, but the meaning was not so easy to grasp immediately. My idea was not good for the publisher, so I understand. But now I can speak with you of contemplatives in action and the meaning of this of these words. The first chapter then outlines the basic norms of the Jesuits after spiritual exercises, the constitutions, a set of rules that Alto, written and adopted in the 16th century, are constantly being renewed right up to the present day, and certainly into tomorrow. This reveals another characteristic of Jesuit identity, the ability to adapt to the world in which they live, to times and to places. In this adaptability also lies the particular interpretation of obedience. The Society of Jesus is organized according to an extremely hierarchical model. Every Jesuit owes obedience to his superior, but this obedience is subject to analysis, to discussion, to reflection. It is a negotiated obedience. The spiritual exercises are a time when obedience can also be thought about and discussed. This ability to contemplate and to act was fundamentally the reason why the Society of Jesus survived the canonical suppression of 1773-1814. The Jesuits had to obey the Pope's decision, no doubt, but not uncritically. The constant negotiation of obedience enabled them to survive and be restored. It's no coincidence that the most charismatic Jesuit Father General of the 19th century, Dutchman Jan Rotan, wanted to rebuild the foundation of the Society of Jesus precisely by reflecting on what? On the spiritual exercises.
I found it fascinating, again, rethinking about spiritual exercise, mostly because, again, we heard this term used many times by Pope Francis, who is a Jesuit. And so I think the word, not necessarily the word of Catholics, but in general, the word has heard this word more often than ever before. Now, let me move forward. I want to ask about one other key feature of the Jesuit movement. As I mentioned earlier, not far away from where I live, you have a Loyola Academy. When you walk into the Loyola Academy, you have a world map, and you can easily see where all of the Jesuit missions are located throughout the world. So in the book, you often refer to the fourth vow, Unus non sufficit orbis, which essentially is about the world sort of a job and missions that Jesuits have to undertake. So can you talk about the meanings of this idea, of this vow, and also its concrete manifestations?
Sure. You know, all religious orders and also priests take three vows: poverty, chastity, and obedience. Jesuits, at least those who reach the highest degree of membership in the order, take a fourth vow. They promise to obey the Pope in relation to the missions. In other words, they say, we are ready to go wherever the Pope wants to send us, to every corner of the world. This promise is closely linked to the time in which the Jesuits were born, you know, the mid-16th century, when Europe was experiencing the Protestant schism and the new geographical knowledge motivated missionaries to preach all over the world. Jesuits studied to be ready to go anywhere. One word is not enough, unus non sufficit orbis, has, in my opinion, a double meaning. One, Jesuits are ready to go even to the new world, you know, the new world, the America in the 16th century, to the other worlds, the unknown worlds, that were then opening up outside Europe. But they never forget the value of the spiritual world, the second world. They are contemplatives in action. And I would like, let me thank Casey Beaumier for discussing this ambiguity in the meaning of the word world. You see, Roberto, I like to point out that a book is certainly a work of the author, but it's also the result of constant comparisons with good colleagues. In this regard, I would also like to thank all the friends and colleagues who have helped me to learn and to write English better, for example, by giving their time. There is in my book an acknowledgments page at the beginning, and I greatly appreciate if the readers will pay attention to my acknowledgments. You know, it's difficult for me as an Italian to pronounce well acknowledgment.
Let me ask about the work of a society in the U.S. in particular. And this is an interesting question, mostly because the largest majority of the listeners of the podcast are based in the U.S., obviously worldwide. But I think there's an interesting aspect here to see the work of the Jesuit, not just in the American continent, but more specifically in the United States.
Oh, it's a great topic. I have already spoken about the big archive in Rome, the Archivum Romanum Societatis Jesu. But for the history of the 19th and 20th centuries, there is an equally fascinating archive in the United States in St. Louis, Missouri. It's amazing. Here are preserved extraordinarily important sources that tell us of the Jesuit experiences in almost every part of the United States, from the Atlantic coast to the Midwest, from the Southwest to the extraordinary stories of mission and exploration in the Northwest, in the Pacific region, in Alaska. Well, what a story. These documents have tremendous narrative value. They are not only about the history of Christianity, but also about the history of exploration, about anthropology, about the history of daily life, about the encounter of cultures. I believe that the history of the United States in the 19th and the 20th centuries is one of the new gold mines for the future of historiography in Jesuit studies. But who knows? Maybe even for literature. Why is this history so relevant? In my opinion, for many reasons, I will mention just two. The first, one of the keys of the survival of the Society of Jesus during the period of the suppression was precisely the resistance of some former Jesuits who were active in the United States, in Maryland. Second, the Jesuits found a way to fully concretize their charism in the United States in the 19th and 20th centuries, what we used to call identity. I'm referring to schools, like you already mentioned, high schools, colleges, universities, but also the press apostolate, so-called newspapers, radio, now wonderful websites. The Jesuits are a very cultural order, shall we say, and the development of their culture in the United States is a path where there is still much to study. I'll give you an example. Their contribution to defining a sports culture in the United States. It's really important. We need to study it better, and that's one of my goals for my future research. I said I'll give two reasons why the history of the Society of Jesus in the United States is so interesting, but I was lying. I already gave three, and we'll add one more, if I may. The mission among Native Americans and the way the Jesuits fought with other Christian denominations like Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, even Mormons. They fought over the occupation of mission territories. And I am sure that knowing this history will help us better understand who we are today in 2024. To be honest, this is also the topic of my current research project, and that's why I'm so excited to talk about it.
Yeah, you mentioned the question of Native Americans, and I was thinking about the TV series 1923, which was a prequel of Yellowstone, where you have a story of this Native American girl that essentially is kidnapped and abused by Catholic priests, which, if I remember, were actually Jesuits. And so, you know, that actually got a lot of attention, particularly about the idea of talking about this connection between Native Americans and the Catholic Church, which for a long time was simply neglected and not part of the public discourse. So I'm not mentioning here the series to talk about the series itself, but to say that certainly it helped to bring about that topic, which was, you know, forgotten for a long time. But I want to ask you something still controversial, because you mentioned earlier that the Jesuits, you know, were eager and still eager to go anywhere in the world, wherever the church, the Pope, asked them to go. But Jesuits as individuals were also bringing their own identity, and often this was an identity connected to nation states that were involved with the colonial enterprise. So I was wondering, in your view, to what extent the society contributed to the development of colonialism and imperialism, particularly in Africa and Asia?
Well, you ask very good questions, Roberto. Thank you, because these questions are evidence of a very careful reading of the book. Thank you very much. The Jesuits are the missionary order par excellence. No? They were crucial to missionary history in the early modern period and in modern and contemporary times. The examples from Asia and Africa are also so important because they tell us a lot about the adaptability we have already talked about. The Jesuits acted differently because they encountered different cultures. In Asia, the Jesuits encountered the cultures that were already highly developed in their eyes, no? And so they tried to become part of of these cultures. They studied the language, adapted their own customs, for example, in food and dress. And some Jesuit missionaries in China even tried to interpret the rituals of Confucianism in order to adapt them to Christianity. In a way, we can say that they wanted to make themselves Chinese. In Africa, things were quite different. Very few wanted to become African. Africa was a very difficult continent for the Jesuits. Many missionary expeditions organized since the founding period ended in tragedy. The climate, the difficulties in many parts of Africa caused the death of several missionaries. However, we can recognize a common element in these two very different stories. The Jesuits did not travel and settle on these two continents alone. They followed the political expedition of the colonial powers. If they did not follow this expedition, they had to adapt to the balance of power and often sought and found protection from the military and adventurers. In Japan, for example, some Jesuits tried to intervene in the civil wars that ravaged the country in the 17th century. The consequences were terrible for the Christians. On this subject, I recommend reading the wonderful historical novel Shogun by James Clavell. The book is almost 50 years old, but it's well worth reading because good literature can sometimes give clear answers, even better than history sometimes. To summarize, my answer to your question is that the Jesuits contributed to emergence of an imperialist and colonial culture, more so in Africa than in Asia. And they did so not single-handedly, so to speak, but through internal disputes and debates.
I want to move to chapter 3. And here you talk about rule and praxis. And I found fascinating that you talk about women, which obviously for me was a little bit counterintuitive, given this is an order for males only. And so I was wondering if you can speak a little bit more about the question of women vis-a-vis the Jesuit.
Well, let me start from rule and praxis. To explain the concept, I use a fortunate expression of one of the first Jesuits, the Spaniard Jerónimo Nadal, who defined the so-called our way of proceeding. He defined our way of proceeding in this way. The Jesuit would ideally possess a virtuous, and I emphasize virtuous, combination of adherence to the written norms, rules, and the flexible behavior that life in the daily world requires, praxis. We have just seen this in talking about China and Japan. The written rules were certainly not about seeking points of contact between religions that were pagan on paper and Christianity. Daily practice, on the contrary, required this. How can this way of proceeding be applied to the question of the Jesuits' relationship with women? I agree with you, it's a great topic. So Ignatius said from the beginning, there should be no female branch of the Society of Jesus, not at all. And in fact, this female branch would never have existed. There were attempts, the most important in Jesuit history being that of the English nun Mary Ward, who tried to found an order that followed the Jesuit rules exactly, but she was unsuccessful. Women were also involved in the history of the Society of Jesus in other ways. They were benefactors. It was thanks to Spanish noble women that Ignatius was able to give economic solidity to his personal life, firstly, and later, that of the order. More, the spiritual exercises contributed to shaping the spirituality of women according to Jesuit ideals. whereby the spiritual exercises were in fact suitable for everyone, religious and non-religious, women and men. The importance of women to the Jesuit economy also led to accusation, donation and testamentary legacies, which were very, very common, especially in the first century of the Jesuit's life. This donation led many of their opponents of the Jesuits to accuse them of influencing the wills of widows and elderly believers. And admittedly, these accusations were sometimes well-founded.
Let's talk about education. We already mentioned that. Can you speak about teaching in particular and the Jesuits' understanding and teaching of science and arts, largely defined?
Consider, Roberto, that Ignatius, when he laid down the rules of the Society of Jesus with his first companions, said, "Ni studios, ni lectores en la compañía, neither classes nor teachers in the society." He soon changed his mind. Let me say that one of the greatest talents of Ignatius and also of his early confreres was that they were able to change their minds. They did not change their minds by chance, but because they carefully observed the world in which they lived. They realized that a good education was necessary and organized the first colleges and boarding schools, which were free of charge. Students paid just for accommodation, not for lessons, and this meant that the inhabitants of the cities where colleges were established could study for free, and there were many of them, many of colleges in Europe, and gradually in other continents too. And this was a great innovation, a real revolution for the time. In their colleges, the Jesuits wanted to educate future elites, and they achieved their goal. To this end, they not only proposed a career based on humanistic studies, but also included scientific knowledge in the programs, starting with mathematics. But that's not all. Among the Jesuits in formation, there were many who were destined to study the sciences, mathematics, astronomy, geography, to name just a few examples. This knowledge was very useful not only for traveling, but also for have a dialogue with the courts of distant sovereigns, for example, those of China. Not to mention medicine, a science to which the Jesuits always paid great attention, and they still do. Because when we talk about the rich educational offer of Jesuit schools, when we talk about the importance of a varied course of study for those who want to become Jesuits, or those who went to the Jesuit schools, we are not talking about history, but also about current events.
I want to move to chapter 4. And chapter 4, I found it personally very interesting because it's about government, politics, and conflict. And this is very much the area, as an historian, I work on. And I was wondering if you can tell us something about the internal structure of the Jesuit and also their relationship with, and I thought it was very important to highlight the difference here, with and within the Catholic Church.
I have already hinted at something in this regard, but it's very appropriate to put things in order. Well, let's start with the internal structure in the Society of Jesus. It's a hierarchical order. A general elected for life, like the Pope, is the leader. However, the general is always subordinate to the Pope. This thing has led to moments of confrontation in the history of the Catholic Church. For example, when John Paul II, on his own initiative, chose a successor to Pedro Rupe, the Jesuit general who was very ill and therefore no longer able to exercise the office. John Paul II chose against the advice of the Jesuit hierarchy, and this choice caused much resentment. But back to the Greece. The general is supported by a number of collegious bodies, the most important of which is the General Congregation, which has elective duties as well as normative ones. The degrees of membership in the Society of Jesus are different. One can also be a Jesuit without being a priest. There are lay coadjutors, another reality worthy of closer examination in historiography. The highest degree is reached with the taking of the fourth vow, which we have already discussed, and which is achieved after a long and by no means smooth course of study. The exclusivity of membership in the Society of Jesus has been a source of annoyance for other orders over the centuries, but also for some pontiffs, not just John Paul II. They even suppressed it. So, one example, the name Society of Jesus. Members of other religious orders, for example, the Franciscans, considered this direct reference to Jesus to be, what? A sin of pride. One Franciscan Pope, Sixtus IV in the middle of 16th century, even tried to order the name change, but he died before he could enforce it. There is always some turning point in Jesuit history, or a lucky turning point.
Now, there is an Italian saying, which is hard to translate, but I try to do my best here, that says that there are three great mysteries in the Catholic Church. One, that not even the Vatican knows how many nuns order are actually out there. The second is that not even the Vatican knows how much money the Salesians owns, whether it's real money or properties. But the last one is crucial for our conversations because it says that you will never know what a Jesuit really thinks. And that brings me to the question of anti-Jesuitism. This is real. This is something that I remember when Pope Francis was elected. You know, all of a sudden, this became a reality as there were people expressing not necessarily thoughts against him as individual, but against the fact that he was a Jesuit. And so I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about this anti-feelings against the Jesuit and Jesuitism as a movement, as a society.
I can do that. I can speak of anti-Jesuitism, but I have to say to our listeners and to you that this is a complicated issue. But that doesn't mean you can talk about it. The Jesuits were and are hated by many. Why? Let's try to answer. Because they were very powerful in the early modern period. There are the roots of the sentiment. Many Jesuits were confessors to kings and emperors, to name one example. Why? Because they were able to build a very effective economic structure, thanks in part to the proceeds of organized trade in the mission countries, thanks in part to the donation of the widows of ancient people. Why? Because they were and are very demanding towards those who want to join their society. Therefore, they provoked the envy of many. There is no doubt that the Jesuits influenced the political events in Europe and beyond. And also this earned them enemies. And these enemies expressed themselves in books and pamphlets in which they often invented non-existent practices and secrets, giving rise to a veritable literature precisely anti-Jesuitism. Enlightenment France is one of the most concrete examples of the formation of public opinion against the Jesuits. The hostility of individual sovereigns in Portugal and Spain was the main reason for their suppression in 1773. In the United States, too, patriarchs such as John Adams and Thomas Jefferson complained about the restoration of the Society of Jesus in 1814. Why? Because they feared that Catholic intrigues could jeopardize the growth of the newly formed Federal Republic. There are many made-up stories about the Jesuits, but there must be a reason for the rise of so-called anti-Jesuit sentiment. I see this reason in their frequent interference in the affairs of political and economic power, and in their frequent decision throughout history to side with someone and not to be impartial. It happened very often in the history. For example, in the reduction in Paraguay, they fought, they took arms to fight against the secular powers.
Well, perhaps one day you will also write about conspiracy theories connected to the Society of Jesus, which I discovered in time as I've been teaching classes on global history of conspiracy theories, that actually they are part of many, and I found it extremely fascinating. But let me ask one last question, and this is not necessarily connected to the book, but it's very much about Jesuits at large. So I want to ask, where is the society headed? And do you think Pope Francis will be an exception and no more Jesuits in the future will become Pope?
Well, I believe that the Society of Jesus is going where the Catholic Church is going, to a world where neither Rome nor Europe will be the center of thought and control. And truth be told, that world maybe already exists today as you and I are talking. And I also believe that the society's engagement in the intellectual apostolate, no? Universities, schools, books, communication, will always be most important. Just as the engagement with the refugees, the last, the poor, the outcasts of this third millennium world in which we live. Perhaps that the one of the refugees is and will be the missionary horizon of the future. And I also believe that the Jesuits' emphasis on culture can help interreligious dialogue. I hope. A new Jesuit Pope. There is no reason to answer no, but to predict when is beyond me and our capabilities.
This was Claudio Ferlan, author of The Jesuits, a Thematic History, published by Institute of Jesuit Sources at Boston College in 2023. Claudio, grazie mille. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Roberto, for having me. And thank you all for listening to this podcast.